Hello and welcome to our CrossCast webinar series. My name is Katie Turner and I'm the Education and Programming Coordinator here at Cross Financial. Today's topic is IRAs and MCAs, how to handle your client's retirement account and crisis Medicaid planning, hosted by our Senior Relationship Manager, Erin Kempin. First, we have a few housekeeping items. If you have any questions during today's webinar, go ahead and type those in the questions section of the GoToWebinar toolbar so we can answer them at the end of the presentation. Next, a copy of today's PowerPoint can be found in the handout section of the GoToWebinar toolbar. We also ask that you please complete the post-webinar survey that will pop up on your screens at the end of the presentation, as we truly do appreciate your feedback. And now let's get to today's presentation. Erin, I'll turn it over to you.
Thanks, Katie. Hello, everyone. Welcome to IRAs and MCAs, how to handle your clients' retirement assets and crisis Medicaid planning. This is probably one of the most common questions I get from attorneys is when their clients have IRAs and how they can be dealt with and how you can deal with them in a crisis planning situation. So welcome, and I hope you're all prepared and hopefully you'll learn something and enjoy it. So a little bit about Cross Financial. We have in the Medicaid space for over 30 years. We are attorney-led, and we provide financial solutions specialized insurance products in order to qualify your clients for long-term care Medicaid benefits. We primarily do that through the use of Medicaid compliant annuities. However, in addition to the Medicaid annuity, we also offer things like irrevocable funeral expense trusts for your proactive planning clients. We offer long-term care insurance. In addition to that, we also have a lot of educational resources such as this webinar. If you have not done so already, I encourage you all to register for a free attorney access account on our website, crossfinancial.com. By doing so, you'll unlock a wealth of educational information, state-specific Medicaid information, and things like that. So we really want to be your partner when it comes to Medicaid planning and not just a product provider. So the goals of today's webinar is we will do a brief high-level overview of the Medicaid program. If you do have some more in-depth questions as it relates to the Medicaid rules and qualification criteria, I would encourage you to go on our website and watch some of those videos and other webinars that we have recorded on there that will do a deeper dive into the Medicaid qualification. As again, we're just going to touch on a very high-level approach on the Medicaid qualification stuff. Next, we'll go over the Medicaid annuity and its requirements. And then finally, we'll go over a couple case studies to put everything together to show how we can utilize a Medicaid compliant annuity with IRAs in order to qualify your client for Medicaid benefits. So now we'll just start with, again, a basic high-level overview of the Medicaid program. So what is Medicaid? Medicaid is a joint federal and state program that is and the Medicaid program we're going to be referring to is long-term care Medicaid within a nursing home setting. So it's designed to help individuals afford their long-term care program. It's a joint federal and state program. So the federal government sets the framework for the program, but each state is going to interpret those rules differently. So the Medicaid planning in Florida will be different than the Medicaid planning in Wisconsin, which will be different than the Medicaid planning in Texas. So it's all going to be the same framework, but again, each state is going to interpret those rules differently. And you'll definitely see that when we're talking about IRAs and how states treat IRAs, whether they're accountable or exempt asset. So in order to qualify for Medicaid, applicants must meet a set of financial and non-financial criteria in order to qualify. So why is Medicaid so important? Well, long-term care is very expensive in America. According to this study, the average monthly cost of a nursing home in a semi-private room, so think two or more people per room, in the United States is almost $8,000 per month. If you annualize that, that's about $96,000 a year. So to put that into perspective, I looked up what it would cost to attend Harvard for 1 year for tuition and room and board. And Harvard costs around $80,000 per year to attend for tuition and room and board. So 1 year in a semi-private nursing home room is going to cost more than a year to attend Harvard University. So these costs are very expensive, and most people don't anticipate this type of expense, especially in their last years of their life. So qualifying for Medicaid benefits can provide huge financial relief for your clients at their end of life stages. And it can just take a huge weight off their shoulders if they have a spouse or family members that are caring for them. So the non-financial requirements in order to qualify for Medicaid, you have to be a US citizen or a qualified non-citizen, must be age 65 or older, blind or disabled. So again, we're going to be referring to Medicaid within a nursing home setting. So meeting this requirement, it's gonna be kind of, if they're in a nursing home, they're likely going to be there because they need some form of care. So probably gonna meet that criteria. And then again, they must reside in a Medicaid approved facility. Typically this is gonna be a semi-private room at a skilled nursing facility. So that's the non-financial criteria. That's typically the easier criteria of the two to meet. Again, if they're in a nursing home, they're a US citizen, they're typically gonna meet this criteria. So the financial criteria is going to be where most people struggle. And there are two sets of financial criteria. There is an income test and an asset test. And there are specific rules for each of these criteria. And it is important to know that something is either gonna be considered an asset or an income. It's typically not going to be considered both. So starting with the income criteria, and this we're going to be looking at the income requirements for an institutionalized individual. So this is going to be the individual that is residing in the nursing home that we're going to be applying Medicaid benefits on behalf of. This person may be single or they may be married. Again, this is the individual that's in the nursing home that we're going to be applying for Medicaid on behalf of. And in most states, the institutionalized person's income from all sources must just be less than the monthly private pay rate at the facility in order to qualify. However, in some states, if this person's gross income exceeds $2,829, you must first set up what's referred to as a qualified income trust, or otherwise known as the Miller Trust. It's only a certain number of states that have to do this. If you are an income cap state, you must set this up. Again, if their gross income exceeds $2,829, any income in excess of that must first flow through that qualified income trust, and then it'll get paid out to the nursing home. If you have any questions on if you're in this state or what a qualified income trust is, again, we're not going to do a deep dive into this. We're just going to briefly touch on it, but we do have other webinars and videos on our website that will do a deep dive into the qualified income trust if you want to learn more and or if you want to know you are in the state that requires that. But at the end of the day, if you need the qualified income trust or not, essentially all the institutionalized person's income will go towards their monthly share of costs known as their Medicaid copay amount. So it's going to be all of their income minus a few deductions. So each month they're allowed to keep a small amount known as their personal needs allowance. This amount varies by state and is typically less than $100 per month. And this is just a small amount that the institutionalized person is allowed to spend on personal items. I like to refer to it as a haircuts and Snickers bars account, because that's pretty much all you're able to afford on a monthly basis by what this amount is. But again, this will be a state specific number. So again, refer to our website, to your state desk reference, and we'll provide you what that personal needs allowance is in your particular state. They are also allowed certain medical deductions, things, insurance premiums, Medicare supplements, things like that they're allowed to pay for as well. And if they have a spouse that has low income, we may be able to take some of the institutionalized person's income, move it over to the community spouse so they can maintain their monthly maintenance needs allowance, as the community spouse is entitled to a specific amount of income each and every month. But other than that, basically all the institutionalized person's income will go towards their monthly share of costs as the copay amount. So this is for the institutionalized person. Now, if they're married and they have a healthy spouse at home, this individual is known as the community spouse. So if you're new to this type of planning, I would encourage you to highlight, circle, star that first bullet point on this slide, that there are no limits to the amount of income that the community spouse may have. In other words, the community spouse can essentially have unlimited income and will not affect the Medicaid eligibility of the institutionalized person. However, in order to not impoverish the community spouse, the government has set forth a set of guidelines that establish a minimum level of income the community spouse is entitled to. This amount is known as the monthly maintenance needs allowance. So if the community spouse's income falls below this monthly maintenance needs allowance, this is where we'll be able to shift income from the institutionalized spouse, bring it over to the community spouse, so the community spouse has that minimum level of income. Again, if you're not familiar with this or you want to learn more about it, we're just going to briefly talk surface level, but we do have more videos on our website that will explore this in greater detail. But just know when it relates to income, generally speaking, the institutionalized individual just has to have monthly income less than their monthly private pay at the facility they're at, and the community spouse may have unlimited income. And that's the general income requirements for both spouses. Now switching sides over to the asset side of the equation. So when it comes to assets, the institutionalized individual, again, whether they're single or married in most states, is allowed to keep $2,000 of assets in their name. That's it. They're only allowed $2,000. They have to be under that amount in order to qualify for Medicaid benefits. Now, if they're married, they have that community spouse at home. The community spouse is entitled to keep a separate amount of assets known as the community spouse resource allowance. And in most states, the community spouse can typically keep between $30,828 up to $154,140. Again, this is going to be a very state-specific thing as to how much the community spouse may have. So I encourage you all, again, register for your free attorney access account, and it'll be, when you select your state, you can see the community spouse resource allowance requirements for your state and their maximum amount that they're allowed to have. Again, if you have questions on this, I would refer you to one of our other videos on our website that'll do a more deep dive into these requirements. So now we know the income and asset requirements. What is an exempt asset? What's a countable asset? What assets are we concerned with? So starting with the exempt assets, these are things that are not, we're not gonna be concerned with when we're looking at Medicaid eligibility. The first is the primary residence. Now, if this is a single individual, there may be home equity limits that apply. Again, that's a very state-specific thing. So look at your state-specific figures to determine for single individuals what that home equity limit is. If it is a married couple situation and the community spouse is living in the primary residence, there is no maximum value of that residence. The community spouse could be living in a $2 million property as long as it's a primary residence. It'll be considered an exempt asset as long as the community spouse is living there and it's their primary residence. They're allowed one vehicle, typically of any value. They're allowed their personal effects, so things you can find in the common home. So artwork, jewelry, electronics, furniture, things like that. Now where you may, if the clients have collectible items, that's kind of a gray area there. They're super collectible and they're worth a lot. Again, that's kind of a gray area whether it's considered personal effect or not. But generally speaking, if it's a collectible type item, it's more than likely probably going to be considered a countable asset. But again, that's kind of a gray area there. And another exempt asset is prepaying funerals. So a funeral expense trust, typically in most states, you can exempt up to $15,000 for one of those as well. Aside from that, those are the exempt assets. Pretty much everything else is going to be countable. So you're looking at checking accounts, savings accounts, brokerage accounts, CDs, stocks, bonds, deferred annuities, cash under the couch is gonna be countable. If they have additional real estate or additional vehicles, typically those are gonna be countable assets as well. So this brings us to the next question. What about IRAs? And this is where those state rules, as you can see on this map, really vary about IRAs. In some states, IRAs will be exempt for both spouses, both the institutionalized individual and the community spouse. In other states, the IRA will be countable for one spouse and not the other spouse. And in some states, IRAs are countable for both spouses. So again, this is where those federal and state rules, really that interpretation comes into play. As you can see on this map how wildly varied it is from state to state as to how IRAs are treated. Now, if you're on this webinar, I'm assuming you're probably in a state where at least IRAs are accountable for at least one of those spouses. So we'll talk about how to treat that IRA and what planning strategies we can utilize to make best use of those funds. So as I'm sure you can imagine, going over those assets and income criteria, typically assets are the thing that we have to plan for, as most individuals, most institutionalized individuals, their income is not going to exceed their cost of care. They're typically going to have too many assets, as their assets will probably be greater than $2,000 that are in your office. So how can we accelerate Medicaid eligibility? Well, we can do so by what's called spending down. So we'll take those additional countable assets and spend them down. Some of the traditional methods we can do that is paying off their mortgage, paying off credit card debt and other bills. You can purchase or improve exempt assets. So if they own a home, you can put a new roof on the home. You can remodel the kitchen. You can make it more elderly and or handicap friendly. As long as you're paying fair market value for these items, it'll be an allowable expense, a way to reduce those countable assets. Maybe your clients are driving a 1990 Buick. We could upgrade that vehicle to a brand new Mercedes-Benz. You can, you know, purchase new TVs. Maybe they need new furniture. You can purchase those things for the home. Those funeral expense trusts, in most states, you can purchase one for up to $15,000. That's a great spend down tool. But the problem is a lot of times, if you do these things, there's only so many things they can buy, and typically they're going to have excess assets in addition to that. Additionally, if your client owns IRAs, IRAs are great. It's a great retirement tool. You know, as you're younger, people encourage you to contribute to your 401ks, your 403bs, your IRAs, max that out. It's a great tool for retirement. They have great tax advantages. However, when it comes to Medicaid planning, it does tend to throw a little bit of a wrench in the planning, because they're not as flexible as non-qualified accounts, those post-tax dollars. You can't just simply change the owner of an IRA unless you have a court order to do so. And if you simply liquidate that IRA account, you're going to be hit with a tax liability. So for these reasons, IRAs, they're great retirement planning tools, but when it comes to Medicaid planning, they do throw a wrench in the plan and make the planning a little bit more difficult. So how can we handle those IRAs? Well, that's why you're here. So we can purchase an IRA Medicaid compliant annuity. So the solution to spending excess assets down after we've done those traditional spend down amounts, a wonderful solution, my personal favorite, is to purchase a Medicaid compliant annuity. So a Medicaid compliant annuity is a very specific type of annuity. It's what's referred to as a single premium immediate annuity, and the Medicaid annuity is going to meet the requirements of the Deficit Reduction Act. So that's a set of rules we have to play with, and assuming Medicaid annuity meets all these rules, because it would have to be considered Medicaid compliant annuity, what it will do is it will convert what Medicaid would normally view as an asset into simply an income stream. So we're taking an asset, we're putting it into this Medicaid annuity, and it's creating an income stream. So it's simply going to count as income. It's no longer going to be an asset. And more importantly, as this presentation is focused upon, we can purchase an IRA Medicaid compliant annuity. So we can take 401k funds, 403b funds, IRA accounts, other pre-tax accounts, and convert it into an IRA Medicaid compliant annuity. So the benefit of using an IRA Medicaid compliant annuity is we're able to move those pre-tax accounts into the IRA Medicaid compliant annuity. And this is not going to be a taxable event. So the funds are going to go into the IRA Medicaid compliant annuity as pre-tax dollars. So what we're able to do essentially is spread that tax liability out over the duration of the Medicaid compliant annuity that was set up, because the funds will be moved into the Medicaid compliant annuity tax-free. They'll maintain their pre-tax status. And then as the IRA Medicaid compliant annuity makes the monthly annuity payments, those annuity payments will be taxable in the tax year that payment is received. So for example, if they purchase a 10-year IRA Medicaid compliant annuity, we're able to spread that tax liability out over 10 years, as opposed to if the client just simply liquidated that pre-tax account, paid full income tax on that, and purchased a non-qualified post-tax annuity. So again, the benefit of purchasing an IRA Medicaid compliant annuity is we're able to spread that tax liability out over the duration of the Medicaid annuity, opposed to being a tax all at once. So when it comes to funding an IRA Medicaid compliant annuity, the IRS does dictate how these funds can be moved, and they can be moved one of two ways, either by a 60-day rollover, also sometimes referred to as an indirect rollover, or by trustee to trustee transfer. So with the 60-day rollover, this is typically the faster of the two options. And this is where the client will simply contact the current IRA financial institution and request a liquidation of those funds. And they're typically going to withhold nothing for income taxes. So they're going to request that distribution from the financial institution. The financial institution will then send a check payable to your client for the amount of the IRA. Once the client receives that check, they have 60 days to put the funds back into another IRA account. In this case, that's going to be the IRA Medicaid compliant annuity. And as long as the funds are put back within 60 days, it'll be a tax-free exchange. However, since the funds are sent directly to the client, made payable to the client, the IRS does limit this type of transaction once every 365 days. So if your client has multiple IRA accounts at the same financial institution, I would highly encourage you to consolidate all those accounts into one IRA account at that financial institution, and then doing the 60-day rollover to make sure you're not violating that one per 365-day requirement. Now, it is important to note that with the 65-day rollover, since the check is getting sent directly to the client, made payable to the client, they will receive a 1099 come tax time that year from the surrendering financial institution. And they receive that 1099 because the financial institution doesn't know what the client is going to do with those funds. It's made payable to them. They may tell them they're going to roll it over, but at the end of the day, the financial institution doesn't know that. So they're going to send out a 1099 form, which is fine. The client just has to do an extra step when they file their income taxes to report that those funds were rolled over. So they're going to receive a 1099 from the surrendering institution, and then the IRA Medicaid compliant annuity company that they're putting those funds in, they'll receive a tax form 5498 showing that they put funds into a tax qualified account. Again, as long as it's put back within 60 days, it'll be a tax-free exchange, and they're allowed to do this once every 365 days. So this is the 60-day rollover method. The other method is what's referred to as the trustee to trustee transfer. This is where the funds will be sent direct from one financial institution directly to the other financial institution. So the funds never go to the client. The check's not payable to the client. The check will be made payable to the other financial institution. It's a company-to-company transfer. And because of this, the IRS allows unlimited trustee-to-trustee transfers per year. Since the funds do not go directly to the client will not receive a 1099 come tax time. From a tax standpoint, the trustee-to-trustee transfer is more smooth. It's less complicated. However, it can take longer than the 60-day rollover. So in order to do a trustee-to-trustee transfer, basically the client is going to complete the Medicaid application as they normally would. And in lieu of submitting a check with that Medicaid annuity application, the client is going to complete some additional paperwork, some transfer paperwork that they will return with the Medicaid annuity application. Once the Medicaid annuity company receives that application and transfer form, they basically sign off on the transfer form, send the transfer paperwork to the current IRA financial institution, who will then Once they receive that, liquidate the IRA and send the IRA Medicaid compliant annuity company a check direct for that amount. Again, because the companies are sent direct from one financial institution to another financial institution, the IRS does not limit the amount of transfers that may take place. So they can do an unlimited number of transfers per year. So either of these two options will result in the same tax-free exchange. You know, it's up to you as to which method you use and how many IRA accounts the client has. As again, with a 60-day rollover, you're just limited to one indirect rollover, 60-day rollover per 365 days. So what are the requirements of a Medicaid compliant annuity? So in order for the annuity to be considered Medicaid compliant, it does have to meet all five of these requirements. So the annuity needs to be irrevocable, non-assignable, actuarially sound, make equal payments, and the state has to be named as a beneficiary in the proper position. So starting with the irrevocable requirement, the Medicaid compliant annuity is going to be irrevocable in every sense of the term. So once the annuity is purchased, it is completely set in stone. You may not make any changes to it. You may not change the owner, the annuitant, the payee, the term. You cannot add funds to it later on. Once the annuity is purchased, it is set in stone and you may not make any changes to it. Additionally, the annuity is going to be considered non-assignable, meaning you may not sell the annuity on the secondary market. There are some companies out there, if you watch daytime television, I'm sure you've heard some of their jingles on commercials. There will be specific language in a Medicaid compliant annuity contract that states that this contract may not be sold on the third party. You cannot assign those payments to someone else at a later date. So there's no secondary market value. They cannot sell that annuity for cash as they cannot assign those payments. The next requirement is the annuity needs to be considered actuarially sound. So what this means is it establishes a maximum term of the annuity may be. So the term of the annuity may not exceed the owner's Medicaid life expectancy. So depending on what state you're in, your state may have its own state specific life expectancy table, or they may use the Social Security Administration Medicaid life expectancy table. So again, check with your state requirements, but let's establish a maximum term of the annuity. And unless you are in the state in the state of Washington or Oregon, this test does not establish a minimum term. So for example, if you have an 86-year-old male and they have a Medicaid life expectancy using the Social Security Administration table of 5.07 years, we multiply that by 12, that'd be 60.84 months. That would mean the maximum term of the annuity that may be purchased would be 60 months. However, you may always purchase an annuity for a shorter term annuity for that. Now, we do have a couple people on here from the state of Washington and Oregon. The exception of those two states, you may use whatever term of annuity you may like, as long as it does not exceed the owner's Medicaid life expectancy. Unfortunately, in Washington and Oregon, their state regs have established a minimum term of the annuity. I'm not going to touch on that any further. So if you're in one of those states, please refer to your state Medicaid manual for the actuarially sound test. The next criteria is it needs to make equal payments. So the first payment of the annuity is going to be the exact same as the last payment of the annuity. You cannot have a deferral or what's known as a balloon payment. The first payment has to be the exact same as the last payment. Additionally, these types of annuities are going to make a fixed number of payments. So for example, if we have a 40-month term Medicaid compliant annuity, the annuity will make 48 equal monthly payments. So the first payment will be the exact same as the 48th payment in this example. And after that, or the last payment, the 48th payment, the annuity will not make a 49th payment. The annuity would be effectively closed out at that point in time. Now the final requirement is the state has to be named as a beneficiary in the appropriate position. So there are always, if there is a minor and or disabled child, that individual may always be named before the state Medicaid agency. And if the institutionalized spouse is purchasing the annuity and they have a healthy community spouse at home, You may name the community spouse before the state as well. However, generally speaking, in most states, if it's not one of those individuals in the state, will have to be named as primary death beneficiary for the amount of Medicaid benefits provided on behalf of the institutionalized individual. So again, these are the requirements for a Medicaid compliant annuity, and Medicaid annuities need to meet all five of these requirements. If one of these requirements are not met, the annuity will either be treated as a transfer for fair market value, subject to penalty, or as a countable asset. So again, all five of these requirements need to be met. So when would you want to use a Medicaid compliant annuity? So your client may benefit from a Medicaid compliant annuity if they reside in a Medicaid approved facility. They're expected to remain at this facility indefinitely. They've exhausted all of their, if they have long-term care insurance, either they've exhausted that or their long-term care insurance payment is not enough to fully cover the private pay, and they exhausted their Medicare benefits. So essentially they're paying out of pocket, and they have assets in excess of those Medicaid compliant annuity. They have assets in excess of the Medicaid limits. So again, you have a client that's in a Medicaid approved nursing facility, they're private pay, and they have assets in excess of the Medicaid limits. If you have one of these clients, a Medicaid compliant annuity may be a suitable tool in order to qualify your clients for Medicaid. All right, so now that we got over the Medicaid eligibility criteria and what a Medicaid compliant annuity is, now let's put it all together. Let's get to the meat and bones of this and go over some case studies that will utilize Medicaid compliant annuity when the clients have IRA accounts. So first, let's meet John and Linda. They're married. John recently entered the nursing home that costs $9,000 per month. Linda was taking care of John in the home. Unfortunately, his condition declined and she can no longer care for him in the home, so she had to transfer him into a nursing home. Again, that's $9,000 per month. John is 80 years old, Linda's 78. And Linda came into your office and she's at $9,000 per month. She's concerned that they're gonna lose everything. She's not gonna be able to pay for John's care. And she's not gonna be able to live on anything because once she depletes all her assets, she's not gonna have anything left over to live on. So she came into your office to see what could be done. So you sit them down, let's take a look at the case facts. So John has income from Social Security and pension of $2,400 per month. Linda's income, Social Security and pension is $2,100. Their cost of care, again, John's cost of care is $9,000 per month. And in this case, they have total countable assets of $350,000. And of that $350,000, Linda has an IRA valued at $100,000. So what can we do here? Well, we know that if they do absolutely nothing and just continue to privately pay for their care, they will deplete their entire life savings in as little as 38 months. And then, and additionally, not only will they not have anything, but Linda's still living at home. She's from everything that we can see, Linda's healthy. She's, you know, going to bingo every Wednesday night with her friends. So she needs money to live on as well. So she needs to maintain her lifestyle within the community. So the more money that we spend on her husband's care, the less money that Linda's going to have to live on. So doing nothing, obviously the worst case scenario here, they don't need your help to do nothing. So there's got to be a better solution out there. So the solution, we can have Linda purchase two Medicaid compliant annuities in order to accelerate John's eligibility for Medicaid. Now, we're gonna have to purchase two Medicaid compliant annuities for Linda because Linda has that IRA and we cannot commingle pre-tax dollars with post-tax dollars. So Linda is going to have to purchase one IRA Medicaid compliant annuity and one non-qualified Medicaid compliant annuity. So when you hear the terms tax qualified or qualified funds, that's going to refer to IRA dollars, 401k dollars, 403b dollars, any type of pre-tax account, those will be tax qualified or qualified dollars. Post-tax dollars are going to be referred to as non-qualified dollars. So if I use that term or if you see that term on applications, things like that, just know that that's what they mean. So Linda is going to have to purchase two annuities, one tax qualified and one non-qualified annuity. In doing so, we'll be able to immediately eliminate those excess countable assets and create an income stream, in this case for Linda, so she's able to maintain her lifestyle within the community. And since we're purchasing an IRA Medicaid compliant annuity for Linda, we'll be able to spread out that tax liability over the duration of the Medicaid annuity for her. All right, so first up, we know what kind of strategy we're gonna utilize. So now let's calculate what our spend down amount is. So Linda, as the community spouse, is allowed to keep the home, their car, furniture, personal property, and in this fact pattern, $154,140 as her community spouse resource allowance. Now, she is allowed to keep that full amount. However, in order to avoid being right on the edge of Medicaid eligibility, we're going to leave Linda a little bit less. We're going to leave her $150,000. And we do this because baby Linda wants to keep some funds that are tied to the stock market that may fluctuate in value, or we just want to build in a small buffer zone in the event that Linda forgot about a small account. So we want to make sure that she's under that asset limit, because if they're $1 over, they're not going to qualify for Medicaid. And John, as the institutionalized individual, is able to keep $2,000 in his name as his individual resource allowance. So they had $350,000 of total countable assets. We're going to leave Linda with $150,000, and we're going to leave John with $2,000. So that means we have $198,000 left over that we have to play with. So that's going to be our spend down amount or our at-risk assets. So we know we want to purchase a Medicaid compliant annuity to eliminate those. So the next step is Linda, as the community spouse, we're going to have her purchase the Medicaid compliant annuity. So it's going to be based off her age, her Medicaid life expectancy. So she's a 78-year-old female, so we just go to our life expectancy chart, we go to 78, we go to female, and we see her Medicaid life expectancy is 10.31 years. We're simply gonna multiply that number by 12 to put it on a monthly basis. So her Medicaid life expectancy is 123.72 months. So this means the maximum term she may purchase is 123 months. The term of the annuity was 124 months, it would exceed that Medicaid life expectancy and would not meet the test, and would likely be treated as a transfer for less than fair market value. So again, 123 months is the maximum term. However, we may use a shorter term annuity for Linda. So I get asked this question all the time for community spouse cases: how long of annuity should I purchase? Well, the answer really is it depends. This is where just having a conversation with the client is going to come into play. What are you comfortable with? How is there a certain income level you want to receive? With IRA funds, we're going to want to think about the tax liability, because again, the funds are going to go into the IRA Medicaid annuity tax-free. However, as those payments are paid out of the annuity, that payment is simply going to be fully taxable in the tax year that payment is received. So you're going to want to strike a balance with the client between spreading out that tax liability and getting those funds back. So, you know, there's that saying, pigs get fat, hogs get slaughtered. So just use a term that you and your client are comfortable with, unless you're in the state of Washington or Oregon. Your state does not have a minimum term for the annuity, so the door is wide open. Typically, the term of the annuity, the average term community spouse annuity that we see across financial, it's usually about 24 to 36 months in length, as most attorneys feel that that's a pretty good balance of getting the funds back relatively quickly to the client, but yet not having a payment that's so extreme that you may offend the caseworker who may make that Medicaid application more difficult for you and your client than it needs to be. Again, just choose a term that you and your client are comfortable with. So after having this discussion with Linda, you determine that a 60-month annuity in this situation is suitable for her and her needs. Now, again, we are going to be purchasing two annuities. One annuity with the non-qualified dollars, which would be $98,000. And remember, Linda had that $100,000 IRA, so we're going to be purchasing an IRA tax-qualified Medicaid annuity with that full $100,000. So her total annuities that she's gonna purchase is gonna total that full spend-down amount of $198,000. We're just gonna purchase one non-qualified for $98,000 and one tax-qualified for $100,000. Now, in this example, we use the same term, 60 months. You could certainly use two different term annuities in this situation. So you could use that 60-month tax-qualified annuity to spread out that tax liability over the 5 years. And maybe for the non-qualified annuity, you wanted to use a shorter term, like a 36-month annuity. You could certainly do that as they are two separate annuities. Just know that the Medicaid annuity rules apply to each, so it can't exceed the maximum term. But in this example, keep things simple. We use a 60-month term annuity for each. So Linda, as a community spouse, is going to be the owner and payee of both of these annuities. Since they do not have any minor and or disabled children in this case, the state Medicaid agency is going to be named as the primary death beneficiary for the amount of Medicaid benefits provided on his behalf. And then they're going to name their children as the contingent beneficiary in the event Linda were to predecease the term and there's money left over after the state's been repaid. So again, we're going to purchase two annuities for $98,000 and $100,000 respectively over 60 months. So now we've purchased the annuities and we're going to apply for Medicaid. So since this couple did not make any previous gifts within the past 60 months, John is going to be immediately eligible for Medicaid benefits. So we're able to immediately qualify for John by purchasing Medicaid annuities. And we're going to increase Linda's income from $2,100 after we factor in her two Medicaid annuities. Her income is now, her income from those two annuities totals $3,320. So now she has total income of $5,420 per month for the next 60 months. So now let's calculate John's copay amount. Remember, basically all of John's income is going to go towards his monthly share of cost minus his personal needs allowance, which in this particular example is gonna be $50. So John has $2,400 a monthly income. We're gonna subtract out his $50 personal needs allowance, which means his monthly Medicaid copay amount is $2,350. That's the amount this couple is paying for John's long-term care, $2,350. And just as a side note, if John was paying Medicare premiums or Medicare supplements, things like that, he would be able to still pay for that, and that would reduce his copay even further. But we did not include those examples just to keep the numbers simple. All right, so what did we just do here? So we were able to immediately qualify John for Medicaid benefits, and we took that monthly cost of care from $9,000 down to $2,350 per month. So this couple is saving $6,650 per month. That is an incredible savings. Again, we took that cost of care from $9,000 down to $2,350. In addition to that, we've increased Linda's income up to $5,420 for the next 60 months, which is more than what she would have received under the monthly maintenance needs allowance of rules. And additionally, we took that IRA, and instead of liquidating it where she would pay taxes all at once by purchasing the IRA Medicaid compliant annuity, we were able to spread out that tax liability over the next 60 months, as opposed to, again, liquidating it and paying the taxes all at once. So again, a wonderful outcome for this couple. So now what happens if John owns the IRA? As the institutionalized individual, instead of Linda owning the IRA, we're gonna use the same fact pattern, but instead this time, we're gonna have John, the institutionalized individual, own that $100,000 IRA, and we're gonna have John purchase an IRA Medicaid compliant annuity in his name, and we'll go over what's gonna happen with that and how we can strategize this so that is not income to John, but we'll structure it so it's income to Linda. So the solution is we're gonna utilize what's referred to as the name on the check rule. Again, we're gonna use John's IRA. We're gonna annuitize it in John's name as he's gonna be the owner and annuitant of that annuity. However, we're simply going to instruct the insurance company to make the monthly annuity payments payable to Linda. So it's considered her income and not John's income. So it's not subject to his Medicaid copay amount. So again, this strategy involves purchasing the IRA Medicaid compliant annuity in John's name, but making Linda the payee of that annuity. And this is referred to as the name on the check rule. So this is the federal citation for the name on the check rule. And basically what this federal citation states is if payment of income is made solely in the name of the institutionalized spouse or the community spouse, the income shall be considered available only to that respective spouse. So by doing this, we're going to instruct the insurance company to simply make John's IRA Medicaid annuity payment payable to his wife, Linda, since Linda's name is the only name on that check. She's the only one that can endorse it. She's the only one that can cash it. Medicaid is going to deem that income to Linda. Thus, it will be Linda's income, not John's income, so it's not going to be subject to John's copay amount. So again, the strategy is used typically when the institutionalized spouse owns an IRA and we want to shift that income over to the community spouse, so it's considered their income for Medicaid purposes. Again, since John still owns the IRA, it's reported under his Social Security number. It's purchased under his Social Security number. He's still the owner of that annuity. So it's we're able to stretch that income tax over the duration of that Medicaid compliant annuity, as John is still the owner of that Medicaid annuity and everything is still reported under John's Social Security number. Additionally to that, another benefit of using the name on the check rule is since John, as the institutionalized spouse, is the owner of that Medicaid annuity. Remember, since he's married, he has a community spouse at home, we may name the community spouse, Linda, as primary death beneficiary, and then name the state as contingent. So ultimately, when John passes away, Linda is going to be named as primary death beneficiary, so she could either receive the remaining payment stream from that annuity or elect to receive a lump sum. So if Linda wants to continue to receive those annuity payments, essentially a new annuity will be set up in Linda's name. And if Linda is not trying to receive Medicaid benefits, she won't have to name the state as a beneficiary on her new annuity that was set up due to the passing of John. So again, this is a great situation where not only are we able to make those payments payable to Linda, but we're also able to name the community spouse as primary death beneficiary on the Medicaid annuity with the state being then contingent. So some considerations when using the name on the check rule is we feel the most conservative option is to structure the term of the annuity over full Medicaid life expectancy. Again, that'll keep that annuity payment as small as possible, and with being able to name the community spouse as primary death beneficiary, ultimately, when the institutionalized spouse passes away, the community spouse will be the first beneficiaries and receive the remaining benefits of that annuity. And we always encourage you to receive paper checks for them when using the name on the check rule, as you can use that paper check as evidence if the caseworker were to question it. You can show the caseworker that, look, this is the annuity check. It's made payable solely to the community spouse. Only the community spouse can endorse and cash this check. The institutionalized spouse cannot. It's only made payable to the community spouse. Thus, it should be deemed income solely to the community spouse. So when using the name on the check rule, again, we encourage you to use paper checks, as you can use that as evidence in the event it is questioned by the caseworker. Some additional considerations to think about is if the couple has low income and basically all of the income is going to be shifted over to the community spouse anyway, you may not want to use the name on the check rule just because it's a newer strategy. It's not as familiar with the caseworkers. So if you just annuitize it in the name of the institutionalized person, the community spouse is going to get all that income anyway under the monthly maintenance needs allowance rules. So it may just be a path of least resistance to just annuitize it in the institutionalized spouse's name. And if the IRA is relatively small, it may make more sense just to simply liquidate it, as with all their income going towards their medical expenses, the income tax liability may not be as high as originally thought. Again, but anytime you're having these tax discussions with your client, we always recommend consulting with a tax professional before proceeding with any of these plans. So now let's take a look at a case study and put some meat behind the bones here. So we're going to use the exact same set of case facts as we did in the first case study, with the only exception that John, as the institutionalized individual, is going to own that $100,000 IRA. Everything else is going to remain the same. So we're going to have that same $198,000 spend down amount. So we're going to leave $150,000 for Linda as her community spouse resource allowance. We're going to leave $2,000 for John as his individual resource allowance. So again, we have that same $198,000 spend down amount. And again, remember, John, as the institutionalized spouse, has $100,000 IRA in his name. So the solution, similar to the first case study, we're going to purchase two Medicaid compliant annuities. However, in this case, Linda is going to purchase one annuity with the non-qualified dollars that's payable to her. And we're going to have John purchase the other annuity with his IRA. He's going to purchase an IRA Medicaid compliant annuity that is owned by him. However, we're going to instruct the insurance company to make the checks, the monthly payment checks, payable to Linda. In doing so, again, since they did not make any previous gifts within the past 60 months, we're going to be able to immediately qualify John for Medicaid benefits, and we're going to be able to increase Linda's income so she can maintain her lifestyle within the community. And since John is purchasing the IRA Medicaid compliant annuity in his name, we will avoid immediate income tax consequences by him simply liquidating that, and we're able to, again, spread that tax liability out over the duration of the annuity. So now we're gonna determine the term. Linda, you know, she wants to use that 60-month annuity like we did in the previous example, in the plan conservatively. In this case, we're gonna have John purchase his IRA Medicaid annuity over his full Medicaid life expectancy. So since John is an 80-year-old male, again, we're gonna look at our chart, we'll go to 80 in male, and we see 7.74 years. We're just gonna simply multiply that by 12 to get 92.88 months, which means his maximum term annuity will be 92 months. And that's exactly the term we're gonna purchase for John for his IRA Medicaid annuity, will be 92 months. So how does this work? How does this look? So Linda, again, is going to purchase a $98,000 non-qualified, so post-tax dollar, Medicaid compliant annuity in her name. Over 60 months, it's going to make monthly payments for the next 60 months of $1,640. In her annuity, again, since they don't have any minor or disabled children, the state Medicaid agency is going to be named as primary death beneficiary for his sent to Medicaid paid on behalf of John. And she's going to name her kids as the contingent death beneficiary. Now, John, for his IRA Medicaid compliant annuity, he's going to be the owner and annuitant of this annuity. It's going to be purchased over his full Medicaid life expectancy of 92 months. However, we're going to instruct the insurance company to make the monthly annuity payments payable to Linda. So John's annuity is going to pay Linda $1,100 per month for the next 92 months. Since John, as the institutionalized spouse, is the owner of this annuity, he is able to name Linda, the community spouse, as primary death beneficiary with the state Medicaid agency for the amount of Medicaid benefits provided on his behalf as contingent. And then he's going to name their kids as a tertiary death beneficiary on that. So now we've purchased these annuities. We're going to apply for Medicaid. Similar situation, after purchasing the Medicaid compliant annuities, John is going to be immediately eligible for Medicaid benefits as we eliminated those excess countable assets by converting it into an income stream. And we're going to be able to increase Linda's income. Linda had original income again of $2,100. She's going to receive $1,640 for the next 60 months from her non-qualified annuity. And she's also going to receive $1,100 from John's IRA annuity payable for the next 92 months. So her total income is going to be $4,840. Now let's calculate John's Medicaid copay. Again, similar to the first case study, we looked at John's income, $2,400 less his $50 personal needs allowance, which means his monthly Medicaid copay again is going to be $2,350. Again, if he had insurance premiums, he'd be able to pay for that out of his copay amount to reduce his copay. So economic results of what did we just do here? Well, again, John was able to achieve immediate Medicaid eligibility, and we took that $9,000 cost of care, and again, we shrunk it down to $2,350. And this couple, again, will experience savings of $6,650. We were able to increase Linda's monthly income up to $4,840. And again, this is more than what she would have received if she simply would have received a shifting of income under the monthly maintenance needs allowance rules. And with John's IRA, we were able to avoid immediate income taxation if he just simply were to liquidate his IRA and given the funds over to Linda. We're able to spread out that tax liability over the next 92 months. And Linda was able to receive that as part of her income under the name on the check rule. Now, some of you might be thinking, what if Linda doesn't spend that income each and every month and she starts accumulating assets? Well, that's fine, because after the initial qualification of John, Medicaid is no longer concerned with the assets of the community spouse. So if Linda starts accumulating those payments and they convert it into assets, as long as it's after the initial qualification of John, again, Medicaid is no longer concerned with the community spouse's assets. The community spouse could, in theory, win the lottery. As long as it's after the Medicaid qualification, it's not going to have any bearing on the institutionalized spouse's Medicaid eligibility. So if you would like to learn more about these planning strategies and others, I encourage you all to log onto our website, krausfinancial.com/Kraus Report, and you can request your free copy of the 2024 Kraus Report. The Kraus Report is your comprehensive guide to Medicaid planning. It goes over in great detail Medicaid compliant annuities, planning strategies, case studies, everything Medicaid planning. It's a great resource. Attorneys look forward to it every single year. So if you haven't received yours yet, again, you can get your free copy by going to krausfinancial.com/Kraus Report. And with that, I will take any questions for the next, we got a couple minutes. So
Katie, our first question is, the 60-day rollover limit at one per 365 days per account or per person?
It is per person. So if the individual has multiple IRA accounts, you would either have to consolidate those multiple IRA accounts into one account and then do the 60-day rollover. Otherwise, you would have to do trustee-to-trustee transfers if they have more than one IRA account. So it is one per individual per 365 days.
Our next question, if you've purchased a qualified annuity in an IRA, is there a way to convert it to a Medicaid-compliant annuity?
Yes, so we can convert that IRA account into an IRA Medicaid compliant annuity by either the 60-day rollover method or the trustee-to-trustee transfer.
Our next question, who is the new IRA custodian of the MCA annuity? Is it the insurance company issuing the annuity?
Yes, so the new IRA custodian would be the insurance company, the Medicaid compliant annuity insurance company. That you would utilize for the Medicaid annuity. That would be the new custodian.
That is all the time we have for questions today. If we didn't get to your question, we will follow up with you later this week. A recording of this webinar will be available shortly through your attorney access account. If you haven't already created an account, head on over to krausfinancial.com/join to get started. Signing up is quick, easy, and free, and gives you access to all of our latest educational content and Medicaid planning resources. Thank you again, Aaron, for your great presentation, and thank you to everyone for joining us today and for completing that post-webinar survey. Have a great afternoon.
Thanks, everyone. Thanks for coming. Hope you enjoyed it. Hope you learned something. If you have any questions, don't hesitate to reach out. I know it was a lot of material and we only had an hour. So again, don't hesitate to reach out with any questions you may have. Thank you.